Evil is back. The Drool King Lotor has returned with a dark energy that can destroy the galaxy. Our only hope? The Voltron Force, a team of five heroic pilots that control five awesome robot lions. When Lotor's monstrous robe beasts attack, the lions come together to form Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And I'm here with Greg Tyler, your co-host. Welcome, Greg.
Hello, Mark. Great to be here again. Great to be here to talk about our favorite Defender of the Universe with Voltron fans around the world.
Yes, and there's a lot of new news coming out of Voltron Legendary Defender. Guess what we heard this week?
We heard who the showrunners and a writer are going to be, right?
Right, because it was introduced exclusively on Nerdist through Nerdist News. Have you watched Nerdist News before?
I watched it to watch the video about this news, so I had never really heard of them except for the Legendary Defender announcements that we've seen so far.
Right, so it seems, you know, we got the first glimpse of the poster and the logo through Nerdist, and now right. we've heard about now. There's the showrunners, the writer, and there's going to be a panel at WonderCon in Los Angeles.
That's wonderful. I wish I could be there.
All right. So let me give you this full announcement, and then we'll introduce you to the showrunners, and we'll announce a little bit about who they are.
Okay.
Okay. So on March 25th, 2016, the secrets of the universe will be revealed, at least the Voltron universe. Voltron returns in 2016 with an all-new Netflix original series from DreamWorks Animation called Voltron Legendary Defender. Now, you can join executive producer Joaquin Dos Santos and co-executive producer Lauren Montgomery and writer Tim Hedrick at WonderCon 2016 to learn all about Voltron Legendary Defender. Now, here's what we know about the WonderCon panel. The WonderCon panel will take place on Friday, March 25th, 2016, in room 151 from 6 to 7 p.m. Here's the description of the panel. It is DreamWorks Animation's Voltron Legendary Defender. From days of long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes the Netflix original series from DreamWorks Animation, Voltron Legendary Defender. Hosted by Nerdist's Jessica Chobot, join executive producer Joaquin Dos Santos, who you know of from The Legend of Korra and Avatar The Last Airbender, and co-executive producer Lauren Montgomery, also from The Legend of Korra, writer Tim Hedrick from The Legend of Korra and Avatar The Last Airbender, and special guests as they unite to form this year's can't-miss panel of WonderCon 2016. Be the first in the galaxy to get a sneak peek of this highly anticipated event as DreamWorks Animation unveils never-before-seen artwork and footage of the all-new series. Panel attendees will receive a WonderCon exclusive limited edition Voltron lithograph. So there's the panel information. What do you think so far, Greg?
I think it's a panel I would love to attend in person. I wish I could, however, I get to watch the panel hopefully online. The information is exciting news, and I look forward to learning what they present and obviously any other announcements that come along. Exciting stuff.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a background of both of the showrunners here. We have Joaquin Dos Santos. He's the executive producer of Voltron Legendary Defender. He's an Annie Award-winning director-producer who began his career as a storyboard artist at Sony Animation before moving to Warner Brothers Animation in 2001. While there, he sharpened his storyboarding skills on Justice League and Teen Titans before being promoted to director on Justice League Unlimited. This led to work as a storyboard artist and director on Nickelodeon's popular children's shows Avatar: The Last Airbender, followed by a move to supervising director and art director on the Adult Swim series G.I. Joe Resolute for Hasbro.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And in 2010, Joaquin returned to Warner Brothers, where he produced and directed a series of animated shorts based on popular DC comic book characters, The Spectre, Jonah Hex, Green Arrow, and Shazam. Now, not long after, he was once again reunited with his ATLA crew, and this time in the role of co-executive producer on the critically acclaimed series The Legend of Korra, for which he earned an Emmy nomination. Now, Dos Santos has been fortunate enough to work alongside some of the most well-respected creative talents in the industry. In his 16-plus years of experience, have prepared him for this role as executive producer and showrunner of Voltron Legendary Defender. All right, Lauren Montgomery. Lauren Montgomery is a highly sought-after storyboard artist and director who worked on a host of popular animated children's shows and films, getting her start as a storyboard artist on He-Man and the Masters of the Universe in 2002. She then took her drawing talents to Cartoon Network shows Ben 10, Justice League, and the Nickelodeon series Avatar: The Last Airbender, among many of the other DC Entertainment, Marvel Animation, and Warner Brothers Animation properties. As a director, Montgomery has worked on the CW series Legion of Superheroes and Cartoon Network's Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated. And
nice.
She directed or co-directed films such as Wonder Woman, Green Lantern First Flight, Justice League Crisis on Two Earths, Batman Year One, Superman Doomsday, and Justice League Doom. So most recently, Montgomery was a supervising producer on the Nickelodeon series The Legend of Korra, which led to her current role as co-executive producer and showrunner for Voltron Legendary Defender.
I got to tell you, I don't watch television that much these days, but the resumes of these folks make me want to run out and start watching a lot of cartoons.
So if you really want to get some background about what you think this new Voltron series is going to be closer to being like, I would start with Legend of Korra and Avatar Last Airbender.
I'm sad to say that I have not watched either of those, but I need to check those out, I think.
I mean, there was a big fan following for Legend of Korra. Sad to see when that show ended. I have to say that when we did Toon Barn's Toon Olympics, it was like 4 years ago, we did, you know, a contest comparing all these shows around the world, and Legend of Korra was one of them, and Legend of Korra, I think, ended up finishing in second place.
Wow, I really need to check this show out, at least a few episodes, just to get a feel for it. It sounds great. I still have to read the two Jack Angel books that I purchased, or actually my mother was kind enough to purchase for me after she listened very graciously to our podcast interview with him. So once
those
are out of the
way. Nice. Thanks,
yeah.
Mom.
Thank you, Mom. So after I get through those awesome looking books, I will have to check out The Legend of Korra at a minimum.
Okay, so I just want to let you guys know we're going to do the best we can to try to cover anything that happens with Voltron Legendary Defender, and if that means I have to go to WonderCon, I'm going to try it, okay? But I'm not promising anything. I'm just letting you know I'm working as hard as I can to make sure I can get there to get some interviews.
Now, my understanding is that you would be flying over where I live. I mean, you're out on the east. You're out near Philly, right?
Yeah, do you want me to shoot down a rope and have you grab on?
I will. I would love to tag along, maybe to hide in the duffel bag or something.
All right. I don't know if I have any of Batman's tools handy, but I'll see what I can do.
All right.
One of the other things that's going on, we had a question from a listener, and that question was, where can you find the original Voltron, Defender of the Universe, 72 episodes of the Lion Force Voltron series. So this question was asked by on Twitter. It was asked by Mazer Tank Spectre. And of course, the answer here is that you can get the original 72 episodes of Lion Force Voltron on Hulu if you have a subscription to Hulu, or if you have a subscription to Amazon, or if you go on YouTube. There are some limited episodes on YouTube that you can get for free. But the whole 72 set, definitely on Amazon and definitely on Hulu.
I would also encourage folks to take a look on Amazon proper, you know, the DVDs and eBay. You can still buy the excellent DVD box sets from a decade or so ago for very affordable prices and get access not only to the episodes, but also to some really awesome extras. So check those out.
Yeah, some of those behind-the-scenes videos that show the interviews with some of the people that made the show.
Yeah, one of the real gems to me, actually my two favorite extras are the pilot episodes. There was a vehicle team pilot episode that had run at NAB in 1984, I think in February, and there were two Lion Force pilots. But aside from the pilots, I love the interviews with Peter Keefe, because unfortunately he's no longer with us for us to chat with and ask about his experiences on the show. So that's a treat as well.
Okay. Some of the things that are going on Voltron.com right now is they just opened up for pre-orders for the Ultimate EX Voltron by Toynami. Do you want to talk about that, Greg?
It's beautiful. it stands roughly 16 inches. I don't know if that's head to toe or wingtip to toe, but it is larger than than the 30th anniversary Voltron, which debuted back in 2004 for their masterpiece Voltron. Mm-hmm. But this new one towers over their 30th anniversary design. It is hyper articulated. The Lions, in particular, have much more articulation than we're accustomed to. They can actually sit down in a naturalistic way, which is pretty cool. I have heard some folks comment that they wish that these toys, that this Ultimate EX, that the construction contained die-cast like we're all used to and love from Matchbox and some of the Toynami releases. But the weight of a 16-inch tall robot with a ton of die-cast would be huge. It would be a little scary to pick that thing up and as much as it would weigh if it had a lot of die-cast. This is made from very, very strong stuff. I'm not a plastics expert, but this thing is built to last. It looks great. It pops in color, and it looks awesome.
Well, I just want to say they had shown some of the images, and we will show some of these images on the podcast page as well, that in the poseable form as just the Lions, and then in that poseable form as the fully combined Voltron. I mean, it's just pretty amazing that you can get your Voltron to do this.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting that this Ultimate EX, I'm not sure how they came up the name Ultimate EX. I don't know the lingo, if EX means something to Soul of Chogokin collectors or anything like that. But they've taken an interesting stylistic interpretation of the Big Bot, and the style is a bit different than we're accustomed to with the masterpiece mold, for example. I think it looks really slick. I think high-end collectors of Voltron merchandise will love this thing. So it's available for pre-order, and it looks great.
Yeah. All right. So why don't we move to our main event right now?
Let's do it.
All right. We have with us today one of the original supervising directors of Voltron Force, the one from Nicktoons. So we're going to talk to him right now, and let's introduce him.
Sounds great. Let's go.
All right, so we're here today with Stephen E. Gordon. All right, you know him as the supervising director of Voltron Force, and we also know him as a character designer, storyboard artist, and director. And we'd like to welcome today Stephen E. Gordon to the podcast. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I just want to say it's an honor to talk with you. Having looked at your resume and looked at the various projects you've worked on, what a thrill to speak with someone who's had such a range of experiences in animation and outside animation. So thanks for this opportunity.
I appreciate it. Thank you. You're welcome.
Yes, Steve, you've had over 30 years of experience in this animation world. How did you get started doing the whole thing? I heard you were like almost like right out of high school doing this, right?
Well, yeah, I was in high school. It was my senior year, and my current art teacher wanted me to, well, she saw an ad looking for artists for portfolio submissions and thought it would be a good idea for me to get a professional review of my portfolio. Figured it was a good way to possibly humble me, or, you know, at least give me some critical feedback other than hers. And it ended up getting me the job. So, you know, the school worked with me to finish my high school as an adult night school. So I started working and graduated later.
So I see that it looks like your first project was working with Ralph Bakshi on Lord of the Rings. Would you please describe that experience?
Well, it was pretty unusual, especially for a kid in high school. I mean, my only other previous art job had been doing portraits at Magic Mountain. So this was quite unusual. I had no clue as to what to do or how to handle it. I'd never planned on getting into animation, even though, you know, as a kid and whatnot, I'd watch animation and enjoy it and whatnot, but that just was not on my radar at the time. So it was quite a growing experience, and I seemed to click very well in the process. You know, I seemed to really fit right in. Within months of being hired, I was starting to assist one of the animators, and then from there I was given actual animation to do. I mean, rotoscope, of course, but still, uh-huh. I was, you know, given a huge scene to rotoscope. From there, you know, I actually managed to get a animator credit on the film. So, you know, I did quite a bit of animation on the film. Well, not quite a bit, but enough to get a credit. And then from there, I kept moving ahead.
So that must have been pretty cool to see your name in the credits on something.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah, it was definitely a strange out-of-body experience, sort of. So
to those of us who aren't familiar with the technical aspect of animation, would you please explain the concept of rotoscoping?
Well, in this case, Bakshi was using a lot of rotoscope on Lord of the Rings, and did so after that as well. But rotoscope has been in use forever in animation, all the way back before even Snow White.
Right. I recall the Fleischers using rotoscoping in their early animation.
Sure. They did quite a bit of it. And I mean, it's been used all pretty constantly for any human type characters. It's rare that it's not utilized for human characters. It was kind of the early version of motion capture, you know, that they use nowadays for CG animation and stuff. Basically, there were different ways to do it, and depending on the era and whatnot is how technological it was. But when I started to Bakshi's, they were taking the film that he'd shot, the live-action film, and blowing it up into registered frames of film. So the whole scene, you know, there was like, it could be anywhere from 100 to 1,000 photographs for a scene that you'd have to make your way through, and, you know, you picked extremes or whatnot for animation, and then, you know, send it down the line. I mean, there are various forms of rotoscoping that he was using, but the best version of it was when you were actually put a piece of paper on top of the photograph and draw on top of the, you know, image, and, you know, altering it as necessary and whatnot, and playing with the timing and so forth. So, which is a, you know, fairly standard version of rotoscoping.
Do the people in the live action footage, do they have to wear, say, high contrast costumes or anything like that to simplify that process or streamline it?
Well, it depends. I mean, the first few shoots that Bakshi did for Lord of the Rings, for example, they were just wearing normal costuming that matched the designs, obviously, but there was no effort to try to make them high con. Later on, they did try to use HyCon versions of those costumes, where the costumes are white with like black piping on it and such. And I'm not sure that helped much. In fact, it might have hindered more than it helped, because when you're rushing through thousands of photographs trying to print them, you're not really looking to see how good the contrast is and how good the gray tones are. And you know, sometimes having gray tones helps considerably.
Oh, sure.
Trying to figure out motion on capes and so forth. So yeah, I'm not sure that there was a smart experiment. And usually in rotoscope, they don't go for the high contrast. I think Ralph was experimenting and hoping that that might make things simpler. Plus, he was also using that some of the rotoscope as what you'd call rotophoto, which, if you're familiar with the film Lord of the Rings, he would actually just Xerox the photographs and try to bleed out everything and paint them so that there was a high contrast image from the photograph that was manipulated. So,
oh, right.
Too. And sometimes it paint out backgrounds with white out and whatnot. And, you know, they had whole legions of young kids. Not that I wasn't a young kid, but you know, just doing the whiting out of photographs, you know, getting rid of the backgrounds and stuff so that only the characters existed on the photo, so that they could then Xerox that and just have the character and place them over the background.
It's amazing to have been in that kind of an experimental environment.
So the stuff that you started out doing was very high detail. It was very tedious work, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, I was a kid. I had no idea. No, what he hired me and a bunch of others for initially was to work with those high contrast photographs, where we would go in and add things like horns and teeth and stuff like that to the photographs that weren't there initially, so that they could, you know, turn some of the actors into orcs and whatnot. I had no idea what I was doing or whatnot, and it's amazing that the film turned out decent at all with what little experience most of us had. But you know, as far as tedium, you know, I had no idea. So it all seemed fresh and new to me, so I enjoyed it.
So you were kind of built for this kind of work.
Yeah, I guess so. Sure. Yeah, I guess I've got a high threshold for tedium. I don't know.
So you moved on from Lord of the Rings and worked on a few other projects. I see on your resume you had mentioned Hey Good Lookin', American Pop, and Fire and Ice. What were your experiences like on those projects versus Lord of the Rings?
They were less tightly, well, it varied. You know, each one had its own pluses and minuses. Hey Good Looking, I actually got to play with some actual real animation, broader character stuff, and you know, I needed to learn quite a bit. American Pop was a very tightly controlled rotoscope situation, and often just by nature I had trouble doing that. I wanted to always exaggerate stuff quite a bit, and so I tended not to get the main characters. So I did stuff like the Jimi Hendrix scene and other things like that. You know, they've given me some of the side characters that actually, were kind of more fun in a lot of ways.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And on Fire and Ice, obviously, that was a whole different kettle, because I was actually the animation director on that, as well as helped with the character design and, one of the key animators. So that was a big leap for me onto that one.
So when you went to the point of becoming the animation director, you knew all the different, you know, parts of the show by that time. You knew what you wanted out of each part of it.
Yeah, basically I knew at least Ralph's system at that time. And he knew, because of my drawing ability, that I would be a good fit for that type of film. And so, you know, there were a couple of animators that weren't too thrilled with the idea that I was the animation director at like 23 or whatever. And, but, you know, everyone got over it. We got through the film okay. And the classic that everyone knows.
Yeah, everybody still talks about that Fire and Ice to this day.
Sure. No, it gets a lot of publicity still and discussion online. I know that.
So then how did you make the jump then? I'm not saying it's an upward jump necessarily, but a jump from Bakshi, where you had learned from the ground up, almost literally, into working for Disney. As I see here, your first project was Disney, was working as an animator on The Great Mouse Detective. How did that happen?
Actually, it was The Black Cauldron.
Oh, okay. My apologies.
No, it's okay. And that was sort of the main reason why. I think at the time I was actually one of the few animators, at least in that era, that had been hired off the street to actually animate. That wasn't the Disney way. Usually they would hire people to go through their system and work their way up to animator. But because I think of my particular skills and portfolio from Fire and Ice, some of them saw something that they thought would be very useful for a film like Black Cauldron, especially since Mike Plug was one of the character designers on Black Cauldron, and I'd worked with him previously on Lord of the Rings and so forth. And, you know, they were having trouble finding people that could do that particular style. You know, he designed a lot of the henchmen in Black Cauldron, so they thought that they could utilize me in that way. And, you know, and I did other things, obviously, on Black Cauldron besides the henchmen. Eventually, I moved up to being one of the main guys on the Horned King.
That's so cool.
I did a lot of the action stuff in Black Cauldron as well. So it was a different experience than what I've been used to. At Batchy's, everything was so tightly budgeted that we did our own cleanup as we animated. And it was great to be at Disney where not only did you not have to do cleanup, you could work rough and there'd be someone to follow you up with cleanup, but you could also redo a test over and over until it was right. Whereas at Bakshi, if you got to do a test two times, that was a lot.
Oh, wow.
So it was quite a nice transition.
When was the first time that you worked with storyboards to animatics?
Even while I was at Disney, I started freelancing some storyboards for people, doing some assistant work on storyboards just to stay diversified a little bit. At Disney, on Oliver and Company, even on Black Cauldron, I'd throw in a few storyboards here and there when I was given a sequence or something and I wanted to fix it. But by about Oliver and Company, I was doing some storyboard work quite a bit. And, you know, those always went to, we didn't call them animatics so much, but story reels at that time. Mm-hmm. And then when I transitioned to TVs, directing at TV, on TV shows, we didn't use animatics for a long time. That's more of a recent development, I'd say maybe within the last 10 years or so,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Where animatics became more of the norm. You know, back in the earlier days of prior to that, I would direct a show and what you'd slug it, which is time the scene on the storyboard and, you know, write detailed instructions. And then someone would then take those instructions and turn them into what they called X sheets or exposure sheets. And then you wouldn't know if you were right or wrong, really, until the color started coming back 6 to 9 months later.
Wow.
So when you transitioned to television, was New Adventures of Mighty Mouse your first project for television?
As a director, I think.
Okay.
I mean, I did some little small things before that. You know, I did like the original teaser pitch presentation reel for Dino Riders and a few other things. And even way before, you know, after Lord of the Rings, actually, my first TV job was at Filmation Studios.
Oh, wow.
Worked on, you know, some Tarzan and maybe some Flash Gordon, but mostly the Lone Ranger.
Okay. So how would you compare Bakshi and Filmation? They seem, at least in terms of, you got to crank that stuff out and the budgets are low. I mean, would you say that they were similar in culture or very different?
Yeah, to some degree, there was a similarity as far as budgeting and stuff. I mean, you knew you were not trying to make great art. Although, you know, at Bakshi's, you definitely strove for it, you know, under a limited basis. But I think at Filmation, no one was under expectation that they were doing art, per se. I mean, I was a layout artist, actually, on Lone Ranger. I wasn't doing animation. A lot of those shows, especially the first season of a show like that, would have a lot of new layouts and so forth. There wasn't a lot of stock being utilized. We could actually create a lot of stuff. And so that was kind of fun. We were doing a lot of a blank page as opposed to working within their system, which is, you know, sort of the Filmation way, which is they had a big stock system that they'd have to use animation and layouts over and over for. But first season of Lone Ranger did not really consist much of that. So,
okay.
What was the show that you worked on after the Lone Ranger?
From there, I went back to Bakshi's on Fire and Ice or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
my career has been bopping back and forth between TV and feature.
How did you decide at the time what you were going to do? I mean, with all that bopping around.
Whoever would hire me. You apply for a job and you see if you can get it. You know, it's just whatever's available. Back in those days, there wasn't a lot available. So everyone kind of moved in large groups. For feature work, there was only, back in the early 80s, there was only Disney and occasionally Bakshi doing something. And, you know, an obscure feature here and there. So there wasn't much feature work going on. Whereas TV, there's, you know, Hanna-Barbera and Filmation and, you know, the Patty Freeling, all types of places. So there's more work available in TV, but, you know, it was seasonal at the time. So you might work 6 months and then you'd be off or something. You'd have to find another job. And
did you have to look it up in the newspapers? I mean, where was it available that you found out about it?
Word of mouth. It's a very small industry. Animation is a very small industry. It's gotten bigger now with the advent of CG animation and such, but it's still pretty small. You know, now it's easier with Facebook and all that other stuff to find out what's going on. But back in the day, it was so small that literally if there was a job opening up, probably everyone knew about it that was interested in looking, you know, still looking for. So
there was a lot of competition then.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a ton of people in the industry back then either. It's grown considerably. In fact, that's why Bakshi originally started hiring people off the street, sort of like myself, you know, straight out of high school, which thankfully he didn't know I was in high school or he probably wouldn't have hired me. But he needed to find bodies, and there wasn't that big an industry at that point. You know, he had every artist he could find, experienced animator, that wasn't working at Disney or doing something else. And, you know, he'd even brought a bunch of people from New York to work on it, on Lord of the Rings. And so but he still needed a lot more bodies because it was a big undertaking.
If you were to compare the animation, the domestic animation market today versus as you approach the industry, would you say that it would be easier or harder for someone to enter the industry today than it was when you entered the industry?
Well, it's a whole different industry now. Now, back in my time, I could start working almost off the street with very little knowledge. You know, they could teach me on the job within a few weeks. You'd be up and running within reason if you had any talent. Nowadays, because of CG and such, you actually have to, if you don't go to school to learn certain aspects of it, then you have to do it on your own. But no one's going to walk in to a studio and be hired without prior technical experience now. It's just not done. So in a lot of ways, there's a lot more jobs and opportunities, but you have to know a lot more walking in than you used to.
All right. So let's take a look at your full repertoire of work here. What is your favorite character design?
That I've worked on?
Yes.
You know, I think the X-Men Evolution stuff is my favorite stuff because I had the most input into that. Being one of the directors as well as the character designer, you know, I got to actually discuss and decide where characters should go and look and so forth. So that was kind of a fun experience. You know, you don't often get that with film. Usually you just, you know, take marching orders and do the best you can with it. But on that one, being able to give my opinion and stuff more than just a character designer would, I was actually able to enjoy it more, I think.
Okay. Now, when you take a franchise, you know, the X-Men, it's been around since the 60s and the characters are fairly well known. How do you impose a unique twist on them to keep it from seeming like yet another presentation of the same material? How do you approach that? Because you said you had a lot of freedom there. How do you go about doing something like that?
Well, in the case of X-Men Evolution, the way it was originally pitched, I think, prior to any of us coming onto the project, was sort of X-Men babies, sort of, you know, because at the time, that was the way to go. Muppet Babies was a fairly hot commodity, and you know, a lot of shows were now going that way. And when producer of it, Boyd Kirkland, was first broached about it, that it was basically that type of an idea. Obviously, they weren't going to do them as babies, but right. know, the idea was, gee, we're going to make them all young high school kids and so forth. So we knew going in that we could reimagine everything to a large degree. We no longer had to adhere to the current comic versions of these characters, and made it easier for me because I was not versed at all in current X-Men lore or anything. I hadn't really bought comics in years. My kids had a few here and there, but I hadn't read X-Men specifically since back in the, Kirby Stan Lee days.
Okay.
Everything was new for, I had no clue who Wolverine was, for example. So, So it was, me basically starting without any prior understanding or idolization of what had been currently going on. I just look at it and like, I don't like that look. Let me try something over here and try play with this and so forth. So
you basically bring things fresh to the table because you yourself are fresh to that table.
Yeah, that helped. And to be fair, I had seen some of the Fox's X-Men series that did adhere quite closely to it, but I really didn't watch it for entertainment. At one point they were talking to me about doing boards or revising character designs or something. It all fell through, but so I kind of looked at it a little bit. And I mean, there were certain things on that particular show that I didn't like. For example, the Rogue character. I hated that old Dolly Parton version, the Southern Belle thing. Mm. So, for example, on our version, we specifically went completely against that version. We decided to make her trailer trash, goth, and that was sort of the stuff that I'd bring to it a little bit. That was kind of what I was pushing for, and it seemed to work pretty well for her.
That's cool. I was just looking through your resume. Did you want to touch on a particular project, Mark?
Of all the things that you've directed, what was your favorite directing? Was it X-Men Evolution again?
Yeah, to be boring, yes. Because, we had a lot of freedom. The producer gave the directors a lot of freedom on that show to kind of do what we thought worked best, and as well as we broke a lot of the stories during lunches and stuff. The three directors and the producer would all go out to lunch often and discuss what we wanted to do and come up with some story ideas, and then we'd pass them on to the head of story and whatnot, and then make them work a lot better. But still, we'd come up with some suggestions and stuff. So that is kind of a nice, unusual situation that we were working under.
Now, for X-Men Evolutions, did you do all the episodes, or were there some that you didn't do?
There were three directors.
Okay.
In each season. I was one of the three the first two seasons. After that, because there was delays between seasons, I went and had to find other work.
Right.
And went to DreamWorks, but I continued doing all the character designs, but I couldn't obviously continue directing.
So what did you do at DreamWorks at the time?
I was a storyboard artist on Shrek 2 and Over the Hedge.
Okay.
And some miscellaneous projects that never saw the light of day as well. So
that was in the days of 3D animation.
At that point there was CG being done for features and stuff, but it was still pretty nascent. It was pretty early on. I was on Shrek 2. DreamWorks was pretty early into the CG at that point. Mm-hmm. Pixar a little further along, but in fact DreamWorks was still doing 2D as we were working on some of the CG projects. Sinbad and Spirit was still being worked on at the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the transition period.
How would you say the process has changed now? I mean, in from the days of cell animation, traditional pen to paper kind of things with cells and whatnot, moving into 2D animation assisted with software tools, and now Voltron Force being an example of a sort of fusion of computer assisted 2D and 3D animation. How would you say that the process overall has evolved over time?
The process has gotten a lot more technical. Like I inferred before, that you couldn't just come in as a good draftsman and be able to learn the trade. You'd actually have to know a lot more than the usual. Even in storyboarding at this point, you have to know Photoshop and such. Mm-hmm. You can't just be a good artist. You have to know some technical skills. So, you know, it's gotten to be a lot more involved. You know, it's helped considerably, especially when you're talking about the hybrid shows like Voltron Force. I think it definitely benefited from having CG Lions and Voltron and whatnot than actually, you know, trying to do all that in 2D. You know, doing those types of hard shapes in 2D become very difficult and stuff, whereas in CG, it's not the easiest thing in the world, but once you've got your models and such, then it's just a matter of how do you move them around like puppets and such and make them work.
Sure. So, like the fight scenes, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, no, we obviously are Voltron aficionados, and watching the 80s series, as classic and awesome as it is, there is a definite inconsistency in the quality of the individual cells, certainly not just with the keyframes and tween frames and all that, but, you know, as this enormous robot with all these crazy geometric shapes is doing, you know, such dynamic action, you know, you do see quite a bit of some less than ideally drawn frames for, and I guess that it's probably a lot less likely to occur now with the refined CG models being moved.
Yeah, I mean, it makes for that type of robots and so forth, those type, you know, vehicles and such, that works considerably better. I mean, you know, then it's just a matter of, okay, how hard do you render them, you know, how, and that was in Voltron Force, that was a constant debate. He's like, okay, that's getting too rendered. It's looking too realistic. We have to pull it down so it matches the 2D animation better and so forth. You know, there's other problems that arise, but it definitely makes the model inconsistency problem disappear to a large degree.
All right. So we can get started talking about how you got involved with Voltron Force. You were at Kickstart Productions at the time?
Well, sort of. Way back in 2009, I've worked for Kickstart off and on. You know, they did Wolverine and the X-Men, which I was the director on as well.
Okay.
And so I was familiar with some of them. And so when they had an opportunity to work on Voltron Force, I guess, I don't know if it was called Voltron Force at that time or not.
It was Panthera Force or something like that prior to that, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that was a series earlier than this one, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You guys would know about that than I would, I guess. I think that was more of a vehicles or something. I'm not sure. But anyways, they approached me about helping them create some presentation material. So for about, you know, 4 or 5 months or something, I worked on some presentation materials for them on Voltron Force that they used to help sell and get money for the series. And then when they did go to series, I think I was busy doing stuff. I don't recall, or maybe they just decided to go a different way. And then they went into production. And then at some point, they felt they needed someone to supervise the production and kind of oversee things. And so they came back to me and hired me to do that. And so I kind of was a supervising director on all the entire season. I went back into a lot of the episodes and played with stuff and helped them at that point streamline their production and move things forward and, you know, helped edit and do whatever was necessary.
Now, did you work hand in hand with John Delaney from AOK Productions?
No, actually. I worked mostly because most of the production was being done in Canada.
Right.
So I worked here in California just via my computer and such. I mean, I'd be making notes and, you know, sending them as emails and so forth, or, you know, sometimes we'd have phone discussions, but, you know, mostly I was working with the editor and with the Kickstart people that were over here and such.
When you worked on the presentation materials, how developed was the concept at that point versus what it was when you came back to work on it in production? Were the designs at all nailed down, or what was it, basically a title and a logo, or what was it?
Well, like I said, I don't even know if they had a title. I don't know if it was being called Voltron Force at that point. I know it was Voltron series. And they had certain ideas in mind, like they had the idea that there would be two young boys. Actually, at that point, I think they were slightly older. I'd have to look at my materials, but I think they were like older teens than they eventually became. And there were some alien creatures that they actually had in the show that never really appeared in the final version, I believe. You know, it's been a while since I looked at it. But so it was close in concept. They knew they had to find a new main character or main characters to bring a new audience in, or that was their concept at the time. And so in that way, it was still the same. But I think they aged them down a little bit for the final version. And I'm not sure there was a – there might have been a girl. Yeah, there was a girl, actually, in my presentation stuff. So
Larmina.
Yeah. So, so there was some of the pieces were there. It just, you know, once they got ahead of story and whatnot, then they, you know, fleshed it all out and went better. But obviously, I guess my pitch must have helped them somewhat to secure funding. So
okay, that's great. So how developed was it? You know, I guess you were brought in when the show was entering production. I assume that the concepts, the visual designs, were pretty well locked down at that point. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, at that point, everything was pretty much locked in. They were fully into animation on several episodes at that point. So everything was pretty well rolling along. And so I couldn't influence too much in the way of character design, though I did help them with mouth charts and some turnarounds and whatnot. And, you know, I helped them work out some animation on some of the cats. Lines and such, you know, things like that. But as far... I mean, I helped them simplify some of the animation that some of the designs that we were able to put into the process further down the line in transition, but it couldn't be so extremely different that it was noticeable to the average viewer. So, when we started working on season two, we had actually made the decision to go ahead and revamp everything. We were hiring a new character designer and everything else, but you know, obviously we never got that to that point.
Well, how was it told to you that there wasn't going to be a second season?
Well, at that point we'd been kind of ramping up, and I was just, you know, given the heads up that, yeah, they couldn't get the funding together or whatnot. There was a financial issue going on, and they just couldn't work it out between the entities that were funding it. So,
no details, just it's not happening anymore? Is that basically it?
Basically, yeah. I mean, it was greenlit as far as this network was concerned and whatnot, and they were glad to take it when it happened. You know, they said, we want season two, and for some reason the studio or the companies that were putting it together just couldn't settle on how to pay for it. So
I remember there had been some buzz about a difficulty on the part of I think it was Mattel, who was a toy licensee, a difficulty in them finding what they called a retail partner. So I assume that meant maybe they were having issues finding a Walmart or a Target or a major chain who would be willing to pick up some merchandise. But it's a little difficult to grasp that. We've not seen any indication of, although we've heard rumors that some toys had been prototyped, we've not seen any evidence of any actual prototypes. So it's a little hard to say. I know that they had gotten pretty far. Ruby's had made some costumes for the show, and Birthday Express had done some paper products, and Viz Media had made some comic book stories. The merchandising was pretty slim. It seemed almost like there was kind of this nexus where everything was going to move forward. So a second season, a slew of merchandise, but then the plug was pulled somehow.
Yeah, that's not unusual for the first season not to have much in the way of merchandising, but once it gets greenlit for a second season, then that starts to ramp up. Mattel had been working with us through the first season to, you know, make sure that they were happy with, like, the vehicle designs and the lion designs and so forth, that was something they felt they could do. And everything seemed to be moving along pretty smooth. In fact, you know, it's been a while, but it strikes me that there had even been some discussion with Walmart about actually having some big displays set up, and they were ready to go on that. I think the actual problem was is that the financial backing for the actual series itself was becoming problematic, but I can't get into too much detail because I only know so much about that anyway. I think the toy company and everyone else was ready to go, but you know, I could be wrong. Maybe that was part of it too.
So did you ever, I'm just trying to to figure out from the point of view of all these different production companies, because there was AOK Productions, there was Five Lions Productions, there was Kickstart Productions, and there was World Events Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like these production teams coming together to form Voltron to get this going. Who did you primarily work with other than, you know, within that the framework of Kickstart, but did you interact with any of the other production companies?
Well, I interacted with the people from, what was it, Worldwide or...
World Events?
World Events, yeah. They
Is it Jeremy Corey?
Yeah, Jeremy Corey and Bob Coppler. I mean,
okay.
The Coppler family, I think, were the actual owners of Voltron at that time. I don't
right.
know if they still do or not.
Yeah, they still do.
Okay. But they were the owners of it. And so, you know, I worked with Bob and Jeremy and so forth. But I was mainly an employee of Kickstart. They were the production studio, the production entity, which gotcha. Means they were hired to make the show. They had little mm-hmm. to do with any of the money other than they would be given the money and they would, you know, utilize it to make the show.
Right.
So it, mm-hmm. it was the other companies like the Coppler's company and so forth that were having issues figuring out, you know, the distribution, the European distribution and so forth as to how the money would be divvied up to make the show, you know, the percentages and stuff. But like I said, that's a little bit above my pay grade.
Understood.
I was just told the very basics.
So. Gotcha.
So do you have a particular episode or portion of the show that you're particularly proud of? From your work?
Well, yeah, I think all of it turned out to be pretty fun. You know, obviously the further I got into it, the more input I had. So I was able to make more changes and play with existing things a little further. But yeah, I think there were some fun episodes that were made. You know, there were some interesting ideas that were being played with.
Yeah, one of the designs that at least appeared midstream in the series was a robot called Awesometron, which was, you know, the three cadets had their own little vehicles and they could combine into a kind of a young teenager looking robot buddy who would help Voltron from time to time. Did you have any involvement in the design of that concept?
No, most of the designs were pretty much set up, especially any CG designs had to be kind of set up pretty early on in the process because even though it makes for easier animation later on, it still takes a long time to kind of work out all the CG issues.
Oh, so like the Predator Robeast, that combining nasty thing, and the Castle Doom Robeast at the very end, that stuff would have been pretty well locked down early on.
To a large degree. I mean, we would, you know, depending on what the story boards called for, we might have to make some last minute, you know, adjustments and so forth. But yeah, a lot of that was pretty much in place by the time I was brought back on.
Okay.
So yeah, I character design wise, I was minimally involved.
Okay. One of the things that I'm actually an enthusiast, I would not call myself an artist, but I have dabbled quite a bit in 3D modeling just for my own enjoyment and mm-hmm. a little bit of animation. And one of the things I really like about Voltron Force is that the lions have a very organic motion to them. You know, they're not just these rigid robotic things. Their spines are very dynamic and their tails are very organic and they move in a very naturalistic way. You talked about things that you had worked on to help tweak that a bit. Did you strive to sort of beef that sort of thing up, or what sorts of stylistic changes did you impose?
One of the most difficult things to do in CG is natural movement, especially when you're replicating something like an animal or something. So I worked quite a bit with the actual animators to try to get like the runs and the walks and stuff to look more natural and stuff. And, you know, and they were very happy to work with me on that. You know, I did a lot of going back and forth with them, you know, showing them run cycles of cats and, or, you know, lions and so forth, and working with them, showing them how to make the movement more natural looking and so forth. And, you know, and I think It was relatively successful, and from what you're saying, it seemed to work for you, so that's good.
Yeah. I think it would have been really challenging to make some of the parts. I mean, obviously these are machines, and so to rig these things, these three-dimensional models, so that they move in a fluid way while still being robots, you know, where you've got the hard armor shells and all that, it would seem that, at least from a rigging perspective, that would be a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I would assume. I'm not a rigger, so it's a little hard for me to speak authoritatively on that, but they seem to accomplish it for the most part, which is good.
Yeah, it looked great. I love the animation on that show.
So being flexible and stuff, and other parts not. So, you know, it seemed to play off pretty well.
I was going to say, you had said that one of the things that you had to worry about was how it was rendered, and some, you know, could have been, too rendered to too much detail, and then in other places not enough. So I was wondering, what kinds of things did you use to make the decisions on that?
Yeah, there were several versions that we'd have to have them go back in and do, because they were too rendered. There's too many reflections on the character, on the lions and Voltron, and there's way too much detail. It looked good, but when you put it up against the 2D animation, it made the 2D animation look really flat. So we had to find a happy medium. Even to the point where we had to control the shadows to a degree, because if you have the shadows moving too naturally on a CG character and the 2D characters don't have the shadows moving as well, then it tends to kill the suspension of belief or disbelief. There's a back and forth a little bit. And I think we finally found a fairly happy medium of less rendering on the lions and such that seemed to work pretty well.
Yeah, I did notice I was rewatching the first episode just to kind of refresh my memory before we met today. And I recall the first episode, the lions having much more metallic look to them, with much more reflective, just general, the chrome on the legs and the rest of the lion bodies. And that did seem to change a bit as the show evolved.
Yeah, there's only so much we could go in and revamp, because one of the biggest expenses in CG animation is the rendering time.
Yes. Yeah.
And so to re-render a whole show becomes very difficult sometimes. And at some point you just have to say, okay, from here on, we'll fix it, or, you know.
So. Yeah.
There was a full episode on the Krydor, Ghost in the Lion, where it was taking place in ice and snow and stuff like that. What were the things you had to worry about with the lion's backdrop of the snow and ice?
Well, anytime you put a CG character in a 2D environment or interaction with 2D stuff, you've got issues. We had to save our moments, even when there was interaction between the 2D characters and the CG characters. So, in this case, I believe the environment was mostly 2D, so they had to find ways to make them work within it. We did some CG background work on it, just to simplify things as much as possible, because that's easier. Having a character leave footprints in CG snow is easier than having them leave footprints in 2D snow.
Oh, sure.
There was kind of a mix. I'd have to watch the episode again, but I know there was a little back and forth, and we had to worry about not making it too obvious when we did go back and forth. So,
yeah, I think there are a couple moments where I recall there's this an episode called Gary, where there's this little Pokemon Kremzeek looking thing that is a 2D element until it becomes supersized into a Voltron sized nemesis, and then it is a 3D character from that point forward. I thought the transition was done very well. And another episode where I believe Sky Marshal Wade, he commandeers Voltron. He stands in the Black Lion's mouth up at the top, and Voltron's face changes into a holographic version of Wade's. And I thought that transition was really effective.
Good. Yeah. I mean, once again, like in the instance of that Gary thing, one of the main reasons why it had to turn into a CG element was so it could fight Voltron.
Right.
because it becomes very difficult, like I was saying before, to have a 2D character fighting a CG character, right, and having any contact. That becomes a whole nother problem. So whenever we could, we'd made sure that, you know, CG elements were in contact with CG elements.
Yeah.
And save our moments. So, but when there was a lot of it, we had to try to avoid that and figure out a workaround.
Were they also CG when Gary had multiplied, when there were a whole bunch of little Garys?
You know, I'd have to look at that again, but it wouldn't surprise me that if we did that, especially when there's when you're basically stamping out a bunch at one time and whatnot, it's easier to do that in CG than it is in 2D. The crowds are much easier in CG.
Okay.
Yeah, I noticed when you were talking about 2D, 3D, and the juxtaposition, I would think that the scenes where the characters have their Voltcom weapons and they're interacting with, say, like the Wade droids, that was Sky Marshal Wade's, you know, human-sized robot characters, I would think that would have been pretty challenging to pull off.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a bit of manipulation that we need to do to make certain things work.
All right, one question I wanted to ask before we get to the fans' questions. Before you worked on Voltron Force, had you seen the other previous two versions of Voltron, the Voltron the Third Dimension and Voltron Defender of the Universe?
No, actually. I was that was kind of a period when I was not watching a lot of cartoons. So, you know, I was sort of aware of Voltron, but that was about it. So,
okay, so this was fresh for you again, just like it was with X-Men, right?
You sort of, yeah.
Okay.
What a fun experience watching that show was. Just to share a personal recollection, my daughter was born in the summer that Voltron Force premiered, and I would often watch the episodes DVR'd while rocking her to sleep. And it was, I have the show kind of linked with her as an infant. And every time I watch it, it's just a special thing. So thank you for being a part of those memories. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So just so you know, Stephen, you're one of the first people that we've actually talked about the actual making of the show, because we had planned to talk to Jeremy and Todd Garfield at the same time, and we had gotten really close to that happening. And then all of a sudden, Todd's schedule didn't work out for it. But we had also talked to Giles Panton, who was one of the voice actors, and he had played Keith. So you're one of the first people that we got to actually talk about the actual making of the show. So this is a real treat for us.
Oh, good. Okay. I hope I've helped a little bit, enlighten you a little.
You have, indeed.
So here we have some questions from some actual fans, and I'll start off with Lorraine Kiamco from the Philippines. Can you take us through briefly what was a typical day for you during Voltron Force episode runs?
Well, it would vary. You know, there would be some days where all I did was review storyboards and animatics, and then there'd be other days when I'd be working with, you know, actual color that was coming in or wireframe images, and It changed from day to day. There was no typical day. You know, there was even a point where we were starting to review music and stuff, and, you know, sound effects and so forth. So I couldn't even give you a typical week, much less a typical day. It was all over the place. It was all catch as catch can for the most part.
Okay. What was your favorite episode out of the 11th? All the episodes that you worked on, IMDb, by the way, only lists you as being supervising director on 11 episodes. I don't know if that was a mistake.
Well, I was supervising director on all of them, but
right.
It could just be a IMDb, while a good resource, is not completely accurate all the time.
Right.
It depends on who gives them the information and who researches it, or if they do it all. I don't know. I don't know that I can recall a specific episode that I enjoyed more than the others. There were some that stick out, you know, like the prison one. I thought was an interesting episode. The Gary episode was kind of interesting and fun.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of lean towards, I guess, where And boy, you're going to hate me. I can't even think of the main character's name, the main boy's name now. I'm blanking.
Daniel,
thank you. Where he started to go bad.
Yeah.
And such. And, you know, that was one of the things that we were ramping up to for season two and trying to find a interesting way to resolve it for season two. So
If I may cut in, what do you recall of, what do you recall of the plot threads for season two? Where do you recall the story? And you mentioned the visual designs being changed. Where do you recall those sorts of things moving? What kind of places were those going into visually and from a narrative perspective?
Well, I know we were dealing with the whole Daniel idea, trying to go back and forth a little bit as to, okay, is he bad? Is he not bad? Is he pretending to be bad? I mean, we hadn't completely resolved everything in our own heads yet. We knew that that was going to be the major storyline throughout. You know, some of the other characters were transitioning as well and becoming more adult-like in their worldview, I guess. And we were going to start bringing in some new characters. You know, it's been a few years. I'd have to go back and read. I probably should have before we started talking, I guess. But yeah, I know there were some things that we're introducing and some things we were wrapping up. I wish I could give you more on that right now.
Can you tell me why Hagarium is so purple and why they decided that that was the evil color?
I don't know who made that decision.
Okay.
Well, the Decepticons seem to gravitate toward purple. Maybe Hagar watched Transformers in the 80s.
Purple, for some reason, and I couldn't even tell you why, has always seemed to be a color of evil in cartoons. Mostly the 80s and such. So,
and wasn't Snow White the queen in Snow White, didn't she wear a purple cloak or something?
Yeah. I mean, in theory, purple is a royal color. Uh-huh. But, I just know if you look at a lot of cartoons in the 80s and stuff, it's like they just discovered purple. So, if you look at the backgrounds and stuff, you can say, my God, there's a lot of purple in these backgrounds and such. So, but, a lot of effects were done purple because, I don't know. Maybe red is a bad color on TV. So maybe purple was a better solution.
So, right. All right. Lorraine's final question was, were there Voltron Force stories in season one that were shelved? And can you share with us why they would have been shelved and didn't make the final list?
I wish I could. I do. That was kind of before my tenure on coming back on. You know, all the episodes had been pretty much written by the time I was brought back on, and we're in some form of production. So if there were something shelved, I don't know. Sorry.
That's all right. Okay, so we're going to switch over to the Keith and Alora group, Twitter and blog, and they're mostly fans of the Keith and Alora relationship, but they're big fans of Voltron. They had asked in reference to the 80s Voltron characters, they noticed that the changes of some of the characters' eye colors happened for this version of Voltron, and they wanted to know, why did they change the eye colors? Do you happen to know that?
No. Once again, that was something that had been determined, I guess, prior to my involvement. My guess is that was probably Bob and Jeremy. You know, they were big fans, besides being involved in the actual, ownership, especially Bob, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever anything like that was done, they had a good fan reason for it.
Uh-huh.
So, but I couldn't tell you what they were. I mean, Jeremy or Bob could probably speak to that much more authoritatively than I could, obviously. But a lot of that was already in place.
Okay.
Prior to my involvement.
All right. So some of these might be story related. So bear with me if it's too much story and not enough technical stuff.
If I can answer it, I will. But, no guarantee.
All right.
A few years.
So they were going to have a portion there when Keith was going to become king. Mm-hmm. And at that point, they were going to allude to or suggest that there was a romantic Keith and Alora relationship, like they would be king and queen.
Right.
So they wanted to know, going into that second season, was that going to happen? And if you had known in any of the story development that happened for that second season?
Yeah, I think that was, if I recall right, the way it was working is Keith would kind of trade places with Allura, where she was kind of the sit at home or sit in the castle character. And he and she in the second season, I might be wrong, but I seem to recall that she was the one that was going to go out on more adventures than he was. And he was going to stay at home and rule from the castle.
Okay.
So I don't know that. I mean, obviously, I guess there's the implied relationship due to that. But I think they were just trying to find an interesting way to switch it up and involve her a lot more.
Yeah, that's interesting because, we had known that Larmina had taken over the Blue Lion.
Yeah.
And that Vince had taken over the Green Lion. And that we had just assumed Keith was going to be in Black Lion the whole time because of what had happened to Daniel and the fact that he was turning evil and that it looked like Lotor and maybe even Hagar was coming back. So it was interesting to see that maybe even Laura had gone out, maybe even in Black Lion. Who knows?
Yeah, I think that was the intent. You know, once again, I'd have to look at the development and the scripts that had been written. But it strikes me that was kind of the main idea, thinking how they were going to accomplish it. I don't remember specifically, but I think she may very well have been intended to fly the Black Lion for a while. So
that would have been awesome.
Yeah. And we had also seen that there was definitely a certain level of sentience that the lions had, you know, that they were able to think and that maybe even Allura was able to communicate with them in some way.
Yeah, I think that was all going to be part of the mix and furthered along in the story. If we'd gone into season two, you know, there was still, you know, not everything had been resolved in our own heads, a lot of the specifics, but I know that there'd been discussion along those ways. In fact, the head of story, the guy who's going to be head of story was Marty Eisenberg for season two.
Okay.
And I assume you know who he is. He's now head of story or producer on Guardians of the Galaxy, I believe, for the Disney.
Amazing. I had never heard that he was going to potentially be involved with the show.
Yeah. I mean, he'd written a couple of the scripts and was going to be head of story, but it was so early on that I don't even think an announcement had been made or anything before we suddenly pulled up short. So,
wow, that's interesting. Okay, I guess Todd at that point was probably moving on to Turbo Fast or something like that.
Yeah, I had very little interaction with Todd at the time, so I'm not sure what the intent was, other than I think they were looking for a fresh. Or maybe it was because Todd was moving on that they needed to find someone. Yeah, I don't recall exactly what the deal was. So.
Okay. All right. Then maybe you would know. Another question that they had was whether there were any outlying characters, minor characters, that could have played a larger role in that second season, like specifically Daigo, the kid that had been involved in the video game and had contacted Vince through the video game.
He lived on the planet of the Lion Riders.
Right.
Yeah, I think they intended on revisiting that, but I couldn't tell you specifically. You know, I believe what the intent was is to visit each of the past locations again, looking for something that they needed. It was going to be kind of a quest season.
Right, because they were looking for that fifth planet to determine what the energy source of Voltron was.
Right. I mean, that was kind of the big goal, the overall arc. And I think to accomplish that, I believe we were going to revisit a lot of the planets we had visited in season one, you know, to not just for economic reasons, because, you know, designs are already in place, but
sure.
it would allow us to revisit characters that we'd seen previously and so forth. But, you know, like I said, I don't know that we'd gotten anything nailed down past the first few episodes, which were going to be like a, I think it was a 2 or 3 season continuity for the first couple of episodes.
Okay.
So the main thrust for the first few episodes was the whole Daniel issue.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that if the minor characters, you know, I really liked the Voltron super fan Dudley, who had his own little mini Voltron. I vote for him to become one of the next cadets.
And they were saying that may have been made off of Mattel's Blazing Sword Voltron.
Yeah, it was the 3D. Supposedly, the 3D model was styled, yes, after one of the Mattel. Yeah, the ultra posable Blazing Sword toy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. You got to remember, Bob and Jeremy were not just involved in the production, but they were huge fanboys, especially Jeremy.
Yeah.
So whenever they could insert trivia or something they thought a fanboy, namely themselves, would like, they did.
So. One of the things that I loved was almost literally halfway through the series, they swapped out the music that was used when Voltron would combine from the I thought it was well written and engineered the music they'd been using to that point, but they transitioned to the actual music from the 80s series, and that was a fun chill up the spine moment every time the robot would form. It was pretty cool.
Good, yeah. Like I said, they were looking for any way they could to satisfy their own fanboy instincts, and obviously that would satisfy any other fanboys as well, I would assume. So.
Well, they had even added Voltron Girl. There was a girl from the Philippines who had dressed up like Voltron, and her outfit was so amazing that they even had a little scene with her in it outside of a convention.
Yeah, no, that was... luckily we were able to monitor the internet and see what was going on, and we would glean what we could from it. So,
yeah, that was great. So, Greg, I'm finished with the fan questions. Did you have anything else that you wanted to ask Mr. Gordon here?
Oh gosh, I think we've covered all the basics, but I would say that. I hope you'll be willing to entertain any questions I might want to ask offline, maybe in the future through email, because I really, really like the show, obviously, and there are certainly things that I will kick myself a week from now for not having asked today. So I would hope that maybe you could be so gracious as to entertain a couple questions going forward.
Oh, absolutely. No problem at all. If I can answer them, I will.
Thank you so much.
And Steve, going forward, we know that you've been at conventions like San Diego Comic-Con. In fact, I myself was at San Diego Comic-Con the last 3 years in a row, and I happened to notice that you did an interview at your booth in Artist Alley, and you sat right next to Jacob Shabbat.
Did I? Who's
Jacob Shabbat? you were sitting right next to Jacob Shabbat, and he had been one of the artists on the Voltron Force comic book.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. I remember. Yeah.
So I basically could have talked to you when I was in San Diego and didn't even realize it.
Yeah. No problem.
It's a small world.
Stuff hidden. No. That's not really what I'm specifically known for. So it's
right.
Not something that comes up often at conventions.
Right.
I do have one more question. To fans of Stephen E. Gordon, where would a fan look to see your most recent work today? What's in the pipeline for you now?
Well, right now I'm storyboarding on a feature, SpongeBob 3.
Wow.
And wow. What else have I done lately? I'm still doing an online comic for Edgrass Burroughs, Inc., called The Eternal Savage, that you can look at, find online. And I'm working on another online comic as well that will premiere shortly, I think. I'm trying to think what else would be of interest. Well, that's I've got several things in development that, me and a couple other people are putting together presentations, and might actually happen at some point if we're lucky. I'm not sure we can answer that question. So we'll see. Hopefully soon I'll have some announcements. We'll see.
Great.
But if you want to find me, Facebook is probably the best place to find my most recent art and such.
You have a Facebook page. It's Art of Stephen E. Gordon. Is that what it's called?
Yes. That's probably the best way to locate my stuff.
Great. Wonderful.
And
thank you.
Where's the next place that people can see you in person?
Oh, well, at the end of this month, I will be at WonderCon in Los Angeles. And then I think the next thing I have is the next one is San Diego. I'm not doing a ton of conventions this year.
Based on the fact that you had just mentioned WonderCon, just for the Voltron fans out there, because they're going to want to ask this, because it was just announced that Voltron Legendary Defender, which is going to be on Netflix later this year, they just announced the executive producers, the showrunners of the show. It's Joaquin Dos Santos and Lauren Montgomery, and the writer is Tim Hedrick. And they would probably want to know, have you worked with those people ever in your travels?
The only one I've worked with is Lauren, and I believe she did some storyboards for me on when I was directing Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes. But other than that, the other names I know, but never have worked with them that I'm aware of. So
what is your opinion of, like, say, Legend of Korra or the Avatar Last Airbender series? What do you think of those?
Oh, great stuff. I think excellent stuff, and you know, I can see why they're popular. So I think it'd be interesting to see their take on Voltron.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? After you've already worked on the previous Voltron series, to see this one and compare notes on this.
Yeah, my guess is they won't reference Voltron Force too much.
Yeah, the storyline?
Yeah, the storyline or the other than the traditional characters, I doubt that they will include Daniel and the others.
Right.
I think each series, just as Voltron Force didn't blindly follow the 80s show or directly acknowledge the third dimension. I think it's good that each series has its chance to stand on its own two legs, you know?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think the one thing Voltron fans are going to regret the most about Voltron Force is the fact that it didn't get a toy and merchandise line like the other shows got.
Yeah, it's a real shame that it never went anywhere. My guess is this new version will have more than enough, though, to make up for it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's...
Yeah, my wallet is already, it's already crying. So.
Well, Stephen, we want to thank you for joining us on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. Any last words about Voltron Force?
No, I'm glad people have enjoyed it. That's always good to hear. And, anyone who feels like hitting me up on Facebook and asking more questions or whatnot, go for it. I'm pretty accessible.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for joining us on the podcast, and we'll see you next time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Okay, Greg. Well, we had a really cool conversation with Stephen E. Gordon, the supervising director of Voltron Force. What did you think of that conversation?
It was great. It's so fun to hear from someone who worked on that series. You know, we are as excited as we are about Voltron Legendary Defender, and I can't tell you how much I'm chomping at the bit to learn more about this new series. I loved Voltron Force, and I still wish the show had continued beyond 1 year. And to hear, to look back just a short period of time to that awesome show and hear from someone who worked on it is very exciting. Loved it.
Yeah, and Stephen E. Gordon has had such a long history of work within storyboards, within character design, within directing, and so many different franchises. And he's worked at so many different studios and everything. I mean, he's basically seen it all.
He has.
So, you know, coming into a show like Voltron Force, where it's a combination of CG animation with 2D animation, and then, you know, being able to direct all that and have it happen and have it look to us like it's almost seamless, you know, like it's almost like you could sort of tell sometimes when it was going back and forth between CG and 2D, couldn't you?
Yeah, but you know, I think it's nice when you use a variety of techniques as long as they don't clash too much, because if you stick with one, it's similar to visual effects. Some people say, okay, we need to use models for our movie visual effects, or we need to use CG or matte paintings or whatever. If you can use a variety of techniques, I mean, the goal is to sell the image, to sell the animation. And I think a variety of techniques, if that gives you the best quality, I'm all for it. And I think Voltron Force looked great, however they did it. However they blended the 2D and 3D from shot to shot or scene to scene, it looked great.
Yeah, there must have been a lot of detail involved in that to get it to all blend together well.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I find some of the interesting things that he talked about also was the season two aspects that we never got into, but... you know, he was starting to work on that kind of stuff, the layouts and the designs and everything like that, and never got to work with it because, you know, the show got canned.
I'm thinking we need to build our own mystery machine that can convert into its own, maybe a Podcastron, and maybe we could go out on a mission to learn more about the mystery that is Voltron Force Season 2.
Right. I mean... Just the fact that he was talking about that there was probably going to be a different story editor, Marty Eisenberg.
Yeah.
I mean, that alone, I didn't even realize was happening.
Yeah, I think we have some more interviews in our future.
Well, you know, I'm hoping to be able to connect with some of the other people that were involved with some of the other production companies. So we still wanted to talk to Todd Garfield, the story editor from season one. And we still want to talk to people maybe like John Delaney or Loris Lunsford who worked, you know, from AOK production side. And then, you know, hopefully we can get everybody that had worked on this from all different sides. And then we can, you know, formulate our own ideas about, you know, what really happened and, you know, what made this show so great. And then what made the show, you know, not happen in its second season.
Yeah, and maybe we could reach out to Rubies, who had made some a child-size Voltron Force costume. I really need to ask them to make a grown-up size one because, you know, Halloween is not that many. You know, it's, what, 7 months away? They need to get on that costume for me.
You know, going forward, obviously, the big thrust right now is going to be Voltron Legendary Defender, and I'm going to try as hard as I can, to, like I said before, to try to make it there to WonderCon at the end of this month.
Awesome. I hope you can make it. And in any case, we will all be learning some really cool stuff very soon.
Yes. Yes. Can't wait. I can't wait for everything that's coming up. I mean, obviously, we still want to talk about things that have happened in the past with Voltron, but I can't help but get really excited about the future of Voltron.
Yeah, I think when Voltron Force, you know, met its premature demise in 2012, you know, given how many years had passed between Defender of the Universe and Third Dimension and between Third Dimension and Voltron Force, there was a part of me that thought, oh, no, we're going to have to wait another decade or so for a new show. But, wow, it's already on our doorstep, and I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited, too. So, and we'll have to close this up, but I just want to say thank you for joining us on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. Once again, we have another cool guest for one of the Voltron shows that was out there, you know, whether it be Voltron Defender of the Universe, whether it be Voltron the Third Dimension, or Voltron Force. But now we're talking about Voltron Legendary Defender as well. So you've got four shows to choose from, Voltron fans. It can't get any better than that, right?
That's right. Until the live-action movie, whenever that happens. And I'm still arguing for Garden Gnome Voltron, so...
Okay.
Or maybe not.
Don't hold your breath.
Alrighty.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us once again. If you want to see us on Facebook, it's Let's Voltron Podcast on Facebook. On Twitter, it's at Let's Voltron. And of course, you know, Greg just joined Twitter, so you can catch him. What's your Twitter handle?
It's at Let's Voltron Greg.
Right. All right. So we'll see you next time on
Let's Voltron.